This is Kathy Damaris, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading from the January 2026 issue of Arizona Highways. Melissa Savigny is the author of Riding High. Remy Kebble always wanted to be a cowgirl. She wasn't born into it, but started riding when she was 4. Now she's enjoying her dream job as a wrangler at the Grand Canyon, one of the most beautiful and most dangerous places to ride. I count my blessings every day, she says. Remy Kebble was 4 years old when she rode a horse for the first time. She didn't come from a riding or ranching family. It was pure chance that her Aunt Vanna took her to a stable near her hometown of Colorado Springs, Colorado, one day. Something sparked. Among the animals, she felt like she belonged. Once the horse love is in you, for some of us, it never quits, she says. It's always there. At Grand Canyon National Park, up to 9 wranglers are employed by Xantera Travel Collection, the descendant of the storied Fred Harvey Company and the largest national park concessionaire in the country. Wrangling is a coveted job for anyone who loves equines, outdoor adventure, and parks. Kebble, who joined the tight-knit mule barn on the South Rim in the spring of 2025, has always had an affinity for all three. By the time she was 6, cowboys at Lost Valley Ranch, northwest of her hometown, were putting her on the lead horse for trail rides. By high school, she was show jumping. Tiny jumps, she says. Kebble traveled with her family, too, climbing to Machu Picchu in Peru when she was a teenager and visiting Glacier and Yellowstone National Parks. But it wasn't clear how she could turn her passion into a career. The most obvious path forward was veterinary school. But I always struggled in school a lot, she says, with science, math, all those things. She didn't want to be a vet but loved storytelling, so she majored in broadcast journalism at Colorado State University and started a podcast called The Outdoor Equestrian, where she interviewed rodeo athletes, horse trainers, and others who shared her obsession. All throughout my life, I tried as hard as I could to be into horses, she says. My family was not in that world at all. Her father, however, helped her find a summer internship at Windwalker's Therapeutic Riding Center in Aspen. There, Kebble helped teens with drug or alcohol addictions and children with disabilities learn how to approach, ride, and care for a horse. Working with equines requires a calm and down-to-earth manner, she says. It's a skill, or perhaps a way of life, that Kebble has cultivated since childhood. The internship in Windwalker's deepened her awareness of the healing power of equines. As she put it, animals never judge you. Horses sync their heartbeats to ours, and that helps them learn about us, she says. They also herd animals. They're very observant. They're very kind. They can tell if they like a person's intentions within the first few seconds of meeting them. She says it takes a kind heart to win their trust. Kebble's dream, though, was to be a wrangler, a career so entrenched in the mythos of the American West that the word is used to brand Jeeps and blue jeans. She spent a summer wrangling at Colorado's Garden of the Gods, where she always rode the same horse, Nemo. I love that bonding experience with the animals, she says. Just one problem. The job was seasonal, and she wanted to wrangle year-round. Grand Canyon National Park is one of the few places where that opportunity exists, so when a position opened with Xantera, she leapt at the chance. I always wanted to be a cowgirl, and now, thanks to the Grand Canyon, I finally am one, she says. Making the move to Arizona to live year-round at the South Rim was a little scary, but she knew this was her moment. I got the job, and I was amazed, she says. This is one of the best places in the world to wrangle, and it's also one of the most dangerous. Canyon mule rides began in the 1880s, and today up to 50 people ride mules along the rim or into the canyon daily. The most coveted type of trip, an overnight stay at Phantom Ranch on the canyon's floor, involves a 10-mile zigzag down the Bright Angel Trail, which has more than 100 switchbacks. The steep trails and cliff edges are the most obvious hazards, and wranglers have to watch the mules and their riders closely on tight corners and sheer drop-offs. Luckily, mules are sure-footed creatures. They're the offspring of a mare and a Jack, a male donkey, so they're related to horses, but with a different temperament. Keble says they're not as friendly to people, but they're steadier and less likely to spook. They mean business, she says with a smile. You definitely want an animal like that in the canyon because the trails are so rugged and thin. Mules, like horses, are prey animals, and every part of their body is built for alertness, long ears that can swivel in any direction, a keen sense of smell, and incredible eyesight. In fact, they have some of the largest eyes of any land mammal set on either side of the head, so they get nearly 360-degree vision. Mules can see all four of their feet and the rider on their back, essentially everything but their own tail. Keble says that makes them hyper-aware of the cliff edge and potential threats. She takes her cue from them. If my mule is looking somewhere, I look where they're looking, and as long as there's no danger, I pet them and let them know you're safe. The canyon's rugged terrain aside, it's a fierce environment for both people and animals with extremes of heat and cold. Snow and ice coat the ground in winter. Unrelenting sun is the norm in summer. Wranglers such as Keble have to prepare for emergencies involving the mule riders and the hikers who share the trail. Exhaustion, dehydration, and altitude sickness are among the most common concerns, so Keble always carries extra water, electrolytes, and a first aid kit. Keble's calm, steady disposition is equally suited to working with equines and with humans in distress. But wrangling isn't just about keeping the mules and their riders safe. It also requires the soul of an entertainer. One of the best parts of wrangling is we tell stories on the way, Keble says. She talks about the history of the canyon, about the 11 tribes that call it home, and of course about mules. One spot deep in the canyon is known as Echo Corner. Mule trains used to pause there so the tourists could yell, "Yee-haw!" and hear the echoes come back. The tradition ended when park officials complained the screams could be heard 3 miles away and sounded like a distress call. Keble always pauses at Echo Corner to tell the story, which generally gets a big laugh. One of my favorites is sharing about the Cole brothers, who were adventurer filmmakers and photographers in the canyon, she goes on. One of the main reasons the mule rides are so famous nowadays is because they took photos in the early 1900s of the mule rides. Kolb's studio, which dates to 1904, is still perched on the rim where the Bright Angel Trail begins, not far from the stone corral where tourists meet their mules. For decades, Emery and Ellsworth Kolb photographed the mule trains as they set off. Then Emery ran halfway down the canyon to a darkroom at present-day Havasu Gardens where he could develop the photos using the creek's reliable supply of water. He jogged back to the top in time to sell the pictures to the tourists who were returning to the rim after a long trail ride. It was a 9-mile round trip with a 3,000-foot change in elevation, and Emery sometimes made the run 3 times a day. The Kolbs turned the canyon's mules into celebrities. Postcards sold at the park in the mid-20th century featured mules more often than any other animal. They outshone the half-tamed deer, the majestic elk, and the picturesque bighorn sheep. The long mule trains lumbering up and down the canyon trails, scholar Yolanda Youngs writes, provided a sense of scale and perspective to the canyon's immense size. That popularity hasn't waned. Today, Zantera's mule trips often sell out as soon as they open for reservations more than a year in advance. People dream of this, Keble says. I've had guests be in tears in the canyon because of what they're seeing and how long they've waited to be out there. That's an incredible gift I get to bestow on people and have their journey be my journey in a sense. Every trek into the canyon is a chance to see it anew through a visitor's eyes. It's a grueling schedule, though. Workdays start before dawn when Keble and the other wranglers rise to saddle and bridle the mules. Of the roughly 130 mules employed by Sandera for pack trips and trail rides, Keble says her favorite for rides below the rim is Marshall, but she also enjoys riding one named Arizona. Arizona is a really bumpy ride because he will kind of hop on the steps going down, and it's like, "Whoa," she says with a laugh, "but he's a good boy. I like him a lot." Occasionally, Keble takes a pack train into the canyon to deliver supplies to Phantom Ranch on the waterless, staircase, steep South Kaibab Trail, but mostly she works with guests. That gives her the chance not only to tell stories, but also to hear them. Everyone has a different story, she says. You always meet amazing people. Visitors come from all over the world, some in search of sublime beauty and adventure, others looking for solace and healing. Being outside in nature, Keble says, it calms us down. It makes us more grounded. It lets us connect with something other than ourselves, kind of step out of whatever you're dealing with. She pauses, stretching for the right words. I think that's what the mule rides do. Is it gives you something to step out of yourself and realize the world is so much bigger than you are. Keble says she never takes the job or the beauty of the canyon for granted. I count my blessings every day, but she also looks forward to her days off. I'm not going to lie. I love getting to sleep in, she says, or to relax with a movie or a book about adventure. She doesn't know yet what the future holds, but as long as it involves equines, she'll be content. Learning to wrangle here really sets you up for great success moving forward wherever you go, Keble says. By doing this, I could really go anywhere within the horse industry. It opens so many doors. For now, it's the fulfillment of a long-held dream, one that means she gets to introduce herself as a Grand Canyon wrangler whenever she meets new people. Usually people gasp, she says. They're like, that's the coolest job ever, and I have to agree. And this concludes Riding High. Kathy Montgomery is the author of Bert Goodrich. In 1853, an admirer recalled that watching Bert Goodrich run the 100-yard dash in college was a horrible sight, perhaps because he stood 6 feet tall and weighed about 200 pounds. Goodrich always got off to a slow start, but after spotting his opponents up to 12 feet, he would get rolling into a tremendous cloud of flying cinders and dirt and come storming up at the finish to win. While he's remembered as the first Mr. America, Goodrich may have been the most versatile athlete in Arizona's history, and without a doubt, he was one of the most interesting. The Tempe native won his first athletic competition at age 14 when he became state diving champion. Once, after winning a 4th of July diving meet, Goodrich joined a road race from Tempe to Phoenix and back. Still wearing wet trunks and running barefoot over scorching asphalt, he nearly won. During his time at Arizona State in the late 1930s, Goodrich broke records in most of the track and field events he tried, scoring more points than all of his squad mates combined. But his attendance in college was erratic as he traveled around the country performing as an aerialist. He also boxed professionally before moving to California to work as a stuntman. A Los Angeles Times reporter called Goodrich the best one of those in Hollywood, writing that he jumped off cliffs, trains, motorcycles, horses, and castle walls as a stand-in for John Wayne, Buster Keaton, and Gene Autry. Between movies, Goodrich appeared at venues around the country, performing balancing acts while ice skating at top speeds and executing handstands atop a 125-foot pole perched on bicycle handlebars. Goodrich learned bodybuilding through mail-order courses from Charles Atlas and Earl Leiterman. Picked from the crowd of spectators to compete, he won his first physique competition in 1939 while wearing borrowed trunks. 2 months later, he beat 88 men in a then-unsanctioned national contest that was a predecessor to the Mr. America event. After serving in World War II, Goodrich opened the first glamour gym on Hollywood Boulevard, with celebrity patrons that included James Arness and about three-quarters of the Los Angeles Rams. Ultimately, he opened 7 gyms, including one in Phoenix. When he died in 1991 at age 84, his wife of 45 years said that before a recent intestinal surgery, Goodrich had still been riding his bike every day and doing 75 push-ups while his coffee brewed. And Jack LaLanne told the Arizona Republic that Goodrich was always doing something for someone. He was really something, he said, a hell of a fine human being. And this includes Bert Goodrich. Kelly Vaughn is the author of Queen Bee Vinyl Cafe. If you've walked down Old Town Cottonwood's historic Main Street in the past several years, you know that Maynard James Keenan, the frontman for the bands Tool, Pussifer, and A Perfect Circle, has made his mark on the Verde Valley town. It started with his wine operation, Caduceus Cellars, and the Merkin Vineyards Tasting Room. Later, Merkin expanded to a hilltop trattoria, as explained in Arizona Highways November 2024 issue. A fried chicken endeavor, 4-8 Fried Chicken, recently moved from a brick-and-mortar location to a food truck, And now, with Queen Bee Vinyl Cafe, Keenan pays homage to his musical roots. When the bright, light-filled space opened in November 2024, the goal was to cultivate not just a place to grab a cup of coffee or a quick meal, but a place to linger and listen to music, too. We play all types of live music and vinyl and offer fresh, roasted coffee along with delicious and elevated food, culinary director Brett Vibler says. I build our menus based on the seasons and what we are growing at our farm. The eggs we serve come from our chickens. The vegetables in our salads and ramen bowls are grown by our farm team specifically for the dishes they're designed for. It's the only way I know to prepare dishes seasonally. The tonkatsu ramen, nourishing and vibrant with every slurp, is one of three ramen options on the menu and features pork belly cashew, locally grown mushrooms, bamboo shoots, and spring onions in a rich pork broth. Other menu favorites include the Judas Burger, a hefty hunk of Wagyu beef served on a toasted brioche bun with sharp cheddar cheese, pickles, Queen Bee sauce and onion jam, and the Devil's Mess, a scramble of steamed eggs, spicy turkey sauces, cheese, guacamole, sour cream, pico de gallo, and crispy rosemary potatoes. The latter is served with a side of toasted ciabatta. Once you're fueled, pay a visit to the record store next door, where you'll find a solid collection of new and used vinyl, along with plenty of band merchandise and assorted gifts and novelty items. You might even consider a trim at Barberfer, an on-site barbershop. So what's next for Keenan and his team? Right now, Maynard is working on getting a gin distillery started in Cottonwood, Vibber says. This will be housed in the original Merkin Osteria location right on Main in Old Town. Soon enough, it seems, guests will be able to walk to each of Keenan's Cottonwood endeavors, maybe even in a perfect circle. Queen Bee Vinyl Cafe is located at 102 East Pima Street in Cottonwood. Phone number 928-634-1173. Website queenbeevinylcafe.com. And this concludes Queen Bee Vinyl Cafe. Kathy Montgomery is also the author of Peregrine Book Company. Right now, politics is out, romance is in, and book clubs are all the rage. But things are always changing at this popular indie bookstore, where like-minded people gather to stock up on hardbacks and paperbacks and talk about the written word. It's a real possibility that Ty Fitzmaurice's house may one day collapse from a critical mass of books. He's concerned about it. So says Peregrine Book Company's website. To the detriment of wherever I'm living, I've always had too many books, Fitzmaurice admits. His wife, Michaela Carter, agrees. We have a lot of books. The situation got dramatically worse after the couple opened Peregrine in Prescott in 2012. Fitzmaurice is a lifelong connoisseur of indie bookstores, and opening his own had long been in his plans. That was why he'd been trying to buy the building next to the Raven Cafe, which he opened with a partner in 2006. The cafe was supposed to be part of a broader project. It was based on Trident Booksellers in Boulder, Colorado, in my imagination, Fitzmaurice says, and then I couldn't figure out a way to get the bookstore adjacent to the Raven. But those plans accelerated dramatically when Barnes & Noble announced the closure of its Prescott store. We were like, we can't live in a town that doesn't have a bookstore, Carter recalls. We need a bookstore, and this is a great opportunity for it to be an indie bookstore instead of a chain. Since they couldn't buy the building next to the Raven, Fitzmaurice and Carter did the next best thing. They rented a historic building down the street and, inspired by Elliott Bay Book Company in Seattle, remodeled the space with high ceilings, exposed trusses, and wood floors. They settled on the name Peregrine in part because of the relationship between ravens and peregrine falcons, which roost at nearby Thumb Butte. Fitzmaurice had monitored peregrine falcons for the National Park Service, so there was that connection too. But he and Carter really liked that as an adjective, peregrine means having a tendency to wander. That was the thing that lit us all up, because the ultimate way peregrinate is through reading, Fitzmaurice says. You can travel the whole galaxy, any continent, any culture. Unexpectedly, the couple got support from Barnes & Noble, which gave them shelving from its shuttered store. Fitzmaurice and Carter also hired some of the chain's former staff. but they got even more help from the founders of Tempe's Changing Hands Bookstore. Gail Shanks and Bobby Summer came up to Prescott and gave us a masterclass in starting and running a bookstore, Fitzmaurice says. Tom Broderson, another Changing Hands alum, went even further, serving as store manager for the first few years. Peregrine Book Company opened at a time when pundits were predicting the death of print. We got so many questions from so many customers. How can you do this at this moment? Fitzmaurice recalls. I didn't really believe it, and I don't think either of us were really concerned. Time has proven them right. The rise in popularity of ebooks was initially sharp, but it declined rapidly and eventually leveled off. I think it's proved time and time again that the printed word is irreplaceable, Fitzmaurice says. One of the more interesting aspects of owning a bookstore has been the window it provides into Prescott's collective unconscious, Fitzmaurice says. He and Carter expected that books about state history would be popular, and that's been constant. The popularity of other subjects has fluctuated with the times. Interest in politics, for example, reached its heyday between 2018 and 2021. Almost none of our readers want to read that stuff right now, Ms. Fitzmaurice says. People get fatigued. What is hot now is romance. But besides giving customers what they want, Fitzmaurice and Carter have nurtured interest in other subjects. With degrees in theater and poetry, Carter has focused on building up those sections as well as literary fiction. Fitzmaurice, who earned a degree in natural history and considers bees his true passion, feels proud to have fueled interest in natural history, science, and nature publications. Although they didn't sell well at first, now we sell a lot of those books, he says. When they find books they like, Fitzmaurice and Carter make them staff picks or suggest them for a book club. Given the extraordinary number of titles published each year, Fitzmaurice believes that acting as a book concierge is one of the most important roles indie bookstores play. If we're just relying on algorithms, Carter adds, how do you find your way out? Book clubs serve what Fitzmaurice and Carter see as another important role of indie bookstores building a community. A lot of people who have moved to this town are grateful to have a place to meet like-minded people and talk about ideas and books, Carter says. In fact, the clubs have been so popular, it's been a challenge to meet the demand. Customers want more and more book clubs, Fitzmaurice says, and they keep filling up. Peregrine Book Company is located at 219A North Cortez Street in Prescott. Phone number 928-445-9000. Website peregrinebookcompany.com. And this concludes Peregrine Book Company. L.M. Boyd is the author of Torito Farm. Torito Farm was meant to be a getaway. Dr. Salvatore Torito and his wife, Yuri, bought land in Wilcox with the idea that it was close enough for a drive from their Tucson home, but far enough away to feel like a true vacation. At first, the couple built a dairy operation, planted grapevines, and in 2022, opened a microbrewery and restaurant. But to be a true vacation spot for others, they needed overnight accommodations, so they began renting out the site's three casita suites, initially meant for friends and family. Later in 2024, they added geodesic domes for glamping. We try to be a destination where people can come and enjoy themselves, have good food, good drinks, explore the area, and just have a nice, relaxing time, Salvatore says. Both lodging options allow guests to enjoy the vineyard, brewery, and restaurant, along with the coffee shop. As the name suggests, the glamping domes were designed for guests looking for a unique experience. Each has its own theme, created by Yuri, and offers views of the farm and the Pinolino and Chiricahua Mountains. And all the domes are furnished with heating and air conditioning, a king bed, a full bathroom with a heated floor, and a kitchenette. The suites, meanwhile, feature access to a common room and patio garden shared by guests. We really don't have to go anywhere, Salvatore says. That said, the Torito's encouraged guests to visit their neighbors, including the Rex Allen Museum, Apple Annie's Orchard, and Fort Bowie National Historic Site. There's wine in the neighborhood, too. The area produces nearly three-quarters of the wine grapes grown in Arizona. However, if a guest's definition of a true vacation is lying low, there's fine dining at Torito Farms Restaurant, interesting beer in the tap room, and wine in the farm store. We're trying to attract people who are looking to do something a little more adventurous, a little bit different, Salvatore says. Torito Farm is located at 6150 South Kansas Settlement Road in Wilcox. Phone number 520-200-7270. Website toritofarm.com. And this concludes Torito Farm. I'll conclude today's readings with a few letters to the editor. I've enjoyed your magazine for several years, but until I read Lost Pony Tracks by Ross Santee, I never felt compelled to write. That essay and the accompanying illustrations brought back a flood of memories of our California horse ranch and riding days. While the well-written story can be enjoyed by everyone, the vernacular used by Mr. Santee is especially meaningful to this old retired cowboy. Only those who have lived it and loved it can appreciate phrases like on the prod, gentle a horse, and when a pony broke in two, or know what a hackamore is. And it's true. The one fact that binds all cowboys together and is always a topic of cowboy conversations is a good horse. Some say you only have one horse of a lifetime, and you know it when you're on it. Thanks for an exceptional story that brought back many fond memories, submitted by Gary Fritzinger of Santan Valley, Arizona. It's always a pleasure reading Arizona highways cover to cover. I'm writing regarding the opening sentence in the article about the Motel de Beau, which references the western end of Route 66 as being in Santa Barbara, California. I've driven large sections of Route 66, including the 158-mile stretch between Ash Fork and the Colorado River, and it's always been my understanding that Route 66 ends at the Santa Monica Pier, not in Santa Barbara. Submitted by Harvey S. Gobus of Long Beach, California. Editor's note, you're right, Harvey, and so were Jill King, Mike Ward, Lane Frank, and so many others. Thanks to everyone who wrote in to set the record straight. We appreciate you taking the time. That concludes today's readings from Arizona Highways. This is Kathy Damaris, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.